Hello, and welcome to Learning for Life at Gustavus, the podcast about people teaching and learning at Gustavus Adolphus College, and the myriad ways that Gustavus liberal arts education provides a lasting foundation for lives of fulfillment and purpose. I'm your host, Greg Castor, faculty member in the Department of History. Announcing the appointment of the new editor of the New York Times data visualization feature, The Upshot, David Leonard of The Times said of my guest today, "He has spent years making his colleagues look good. He's done it for The Upshot staff since its founding in 2014, and he did it for me even before The Upshot. He's creative, generous, hardworking, and almost as funny as he thinks he is." Kevin Quayle graduated from Gustavus in 2003 with a major in physics. He went on to serve in the Peace Corps in South Africa and earn a master's degree from the Missouri School of Journalism. He joined The Times in 2008 and became a deputy editor of The Upshot 8 years later. As both a longtime reader of The Times and one of The Upshot's many fans, with its innovative, illuminating, and always interesting data visualizations of an amazing array of topics, like how weird is the heat in Portland, Seattle, and Vancouver, or at Chipotle, how many calories do people really eat, I was truly delighted to learn that the feature's current editor is a Gustavus graduate. I'm even more delighted to speak with him today about his journey since graduating from Gustavus and his work at our nation's premium newspaper. So, Kevin, welcome to Learning for Life. It's great to have you on.
Thanks for having me. Nice to be here.
Yeah, good to meet. We overlapped at Gustavus, obviously, but didn't really know each other. So thanks again so much. I like to start with people's background. So why don't you tell us a little bit about where you grew up, first of all?
Sure. I'm a Minnesotan. I'm a suburban kid. So I am from the western suburbs. My parents are from Plymouth, or I grew up in Plymouth right near the, if you know your Twin Cities, 394 and Hopkins Crossroad. On the eastern side of Plymouth, because it extends quite far west these days, but sort of right there by Ridgedale. Actually, my first job was at the Ridgedale Burger King when I was 14. And then I went to Benilde St. Margaret's High School. That constitutes my I was there the whole time.
Is that, by the way, is that the Crossroads? Where's the Crossroads Delicatessen or something? That's not near you.
I couldn't tell you, or maybe if that's closer to Hopkins, but a restaurant that I know.
Okay, that's okay. Yeah, just checking. Whatever delis I can get, you're in New York. And so, your parents didn't go to Gustavus, or did? Did you have a family connection?
My dad went to St. John's for a year. He was, and then transferred to the University of Minnesota. And my mom also went to, she went to the College of St. Catherine, but Gustavus was not, it was not like a family thing or anything like that. It was sort of random, honestly.
We'll get to how you got there. Did you grow up Catholic or?
Tough to answer that question. I grew up in a Catholic household, I went to church a lot I was a kid, but I wouldn't say it was like getting a Catholic education was certainly really important to my parents and my grandparents, but it wasn't. It was more because of more like Jesuit rather than like you need to learn about Jesus, so to speak. It was a Catholic household for sure. I have seven brothers and sisters. So, answer the question for itself.
That's amazing. Okay. What, because a great school, St. John's. I think St. John's and St. Med's have merged now and St. Kate's, of course. Are your parents retired or what are they doing or what did they do?
Yeah, they're both retired. My dad was a electrical engineer. He started a business, and he also went into engineering sales. So he worked with basically electrical engineering and microchips. He knows a lot about those things. And my mom is an accountant, and she was an accountant. She still does part-time accounting work for a firm in the Twin Cities area, but she was an accountant and obviously raised a huge family we were growing up. So yeah,
that's really good. Where are you in the pecking order of the siblings?
I am number two.
Number two. Okay. Well, mm-hmm. That's not bad.
No, it's not bad.
Yeah. So, I'm listening to you talk about your dad and his engineering, skills and knowledge. Is that sort of how you come by your physics interest or what were your interests in high school?
That's a great question. I couldn't tell you that I was always interested in physics. So I was a physics major at Gustavus, but I think, so much of what happens to you when you look back on it is basically random. So when you apply for college, they have you, at the time they say what are your interests? What majors might you be interested in? And I remember filled out 10 things, astronomy, physics, English. I just had no writing, whatever. I had no idea. But when you go to, at the time, this is in the year, you know, 1999, I think, this was before the onset of, registering electronically. So they, it was very important, or it was like a feature of Gustavus at the time where they're like, unlike other places, we will, your parents are not allowed to help you pick your first round of classes. So you would meet one-on-one with a faculty member in person and you'd go over it. That was like a feature. You know, you could meet one-on-one with a professor and together the two of you will draft your classes for your first year. So the professor who I was matched with said, oh, interesting. Here, it says you're interested in physics. Okay, well, you know, that's a four-year major. If you want to graduate in 4 years, it's probably good to get started with that. And we should probably line you up with Calc 1 because that also is needs to be taken concurrently. And the guy's name was Steve Melama, and he was the chair of the physics department. So I feel like
and he's still there, Professor.
If I was there with him, if I was there with another professor, I have no idea what major I would have been steered to. I mean, I was obviously interested in the major, of course, but it was lucky or serendipitous or some other word that it was the chair of the physics department at the time who was there and who helped me get in that class. That's and I never left.
Great. That's so funny. Yeah, Steve's a great guy. He's still there, and he's an alum himself. I can't remember what year, but that's wonderful. I love those kinds of stories. So, but
he gave
you must
me
have-
many C's and D's on my tests in college. Oh, I remember him very well.
oh my goodness, I've sat in on some physics classes. What? In fact, I sat in on one of Steve's classes years ago. I'm a fabulous teacher, but oh my goodness,
he's outstanding for sure.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was most of it way over my head. What? But you must have been prepared. I mean, taking math courses or science courses in high school.
For sure, yeah, I had a great education at Pendleton Margaret's. There's no doubt, and I think I was always interested in science and in more technical things. And, but I was also, you know, interested in, I was a sports editor of the school's newspaper. And so I was always interested in both. I think like that duality, I was like, I was interested in liberal arts and in writing and in English. So I was an English minor, not that I don't think minors matter in any capacity anymore, but, like there, I was interested in sort of the intersection of those things or being able, I was like, a good writer for a physics student and a great at science for an English major, but I was not good at physics for a physics major. And I wasn't the best writer in a room out of a room of writers. If that makes sense.
Well, you graduated. That's the main thing.
I did graduate. Yes.
So how did you come to Gustavus? What was is there a straight line there from high school to Gustavus or?
I wasn't, you know, I applied to a few schools and, you know, I didn't like really have a real strong, I was mostly uncertainty was the ruler of the day, I think, more than like, I know that I want to go here or whatever. And I think I went to Catholic high school and I wouldn't say that it constitutes like an act of independence by going to Gustavus from a school like Pendleton Margaret's, but I like fully 10% of my class went to St. John's and I was like, I do not want to do that. So I wouldn't, again, I'm not calling going to Gustavus by any stretch of imagination an act of rebellion, but I feel like it was something that I think I was the only person from my high school to go there. And I thought it was just, I got a good, I got a good financial package and an academic scholarship from Gustavus and it made sense. And I was also a mediocre soccer player. And so I played soccer for the team for all 4 years. So that was a big part of my decision. Yeah.
Yeah. I think, I'm always saying, I mean, students come to Gustavus, probably any school. I mean, they usually don't come for its general education program, though it's hard to convince some people of that, but come for, you know how they feel if they do that. I don't know if you did a campus visit or campus tours. That's you do that really well, or you know, for sports or some co-curricular activity, and of course, what kind of scholarships we're getting. I was similar, by the way. I chose Northern Illinois University to be different because so many of my friends were going to the University of Illinois. I grew up in the burbs of Chicago. University of Illinois, you know, Urbana-Champaign. I just said, I'll try Northern. I really know anything about it, but it turned out to have this phenomenal history department. So it worked out. And of course, Gustavus has a phenomenal physics department, right?
For they do,
the longest time, yeah. So, we'll stipulate though it wasn't your own mini Protestant Reformation.
No, I did end up studying the Protestant Reformation. I'm not Lutheran nor Swedish, but I went to a Swedish Lutheran school. But I ended up going on a study abroad trip.
Yeah, that's where I was
East Germany.
Go.
Yeah, and that was. I learned a lot about Martin Luther for a kid who went to Catholic school.
That's literally what I wanted to ask you because I know my then colleague, now retired professor emeritus Tom Emmert, was leading that, right? Tom Emmert of the history department when you were on.
That's right. I doubt he would remember me, but yeah, he was an outstanding history teacher, and he I think he was mostly, his expertise, I think, was like the Balkans, but he knew a lot about Germany and East Germany and communist and USSR and everything. So he, that was my junior year, and it was a 5-month program. So I don't, like, at the time it was semester and J term. So it was like a little bit longer than one semester. And it was a program where they moved you through three cities. It was very interesting. You lived with a family for 2 months. They lived in Erfurt, where Martin Luther, I believe, studied to be a lawyer. And we lived in an Augustinian monastery for a month, which was pretty strange. And then we lived in Berlin for 2 months. I believe it's because the program used to be in Magdeburg, or I think it was a city called Magdeburg, and that the students found it so boring there that they revolted. And then I was like the first year where they're like, no, we'll go to take him, send him to Berlin instead. And that was really great.
Oh, I'm envious. I'm so envious. We have an awesome study away department and program. So that was one. I don't even know if Gustavus still does that. I know he did it for a few years at least. But I remember Tom, and Tom would remember you. By the way, he does remember you because I told him in an email that we're podcasting.
Yeah. That's great to hear. He's an outstanding teacher.
Yeah, Tom's great. We miss him. He's just good and a dear friend. I'm lucky, by the way. I had such great, all the colleagues in the history department have always been awesome, including the guys who've, they were all guys now. Well, and my wife, Kate, now retired. excuse me. The soccer, was that, I mean, how big of a, were there other co-curricular activities that played an important role in your experience at Gustavus?
No, soccer was a really big one. Again, I was not, as Larry Zalenzo, I'm sure, would be thrilled to tell you that he was the coach at the time. I was not super important to the outcome of the games, I think. You know, I played varsity with quotes around it junior and senior year, and like a good game for me would be for me to be in for 15 minutes out of the 90. Like that would be, I would have been pleased with that kind of playing time. But it was a really great group of friends. Some of my best friends now still are people that I met through the team. And so that is it also just provided a great structure. Like oddly, my grades were better in season than they were out of season, even though, you know, there was practice 6 days a week. So
yeah,
it was a really, that was a great experience for sure at Gustavus. It was a
people
and the program.
Yeah. And what you just said about your grades being better during the season, I love, teaching athletes. I have a lot, for some reason, I don't know how it started, but I have a lot of football players, but they're disciplined and they know how to use their time. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know if that's a direct call, you know, but I think there's some relationship there.
I think the constraint just forces you to, you know, have better time management decisions because you have less time. And so you just have to use it. It's like when you need something done, ask the busiest person, you know. I feel like that sort of thing applies to student athletes in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, I know this with the football staff as well, especially, but you know, the coaches care about your academics. It's not like just be on the team and they'll never, you know, care whether you're doing poorly or not. And
for sure, in the Division III, you know, there's no, for nearly all Division III students, that no one is there is pretending that they have a professional life ahead of them. So there's no one. We all, everyone, coaches and players, know that like your education and your work obviously needs to come first.
Yes, exactly. You didn't have your eyes set on the World Cup, you mean? I guess not.
No. I mean, no matter what my eyes were set on, I think if you're playing a Division III and you're 20 years old, you're already gone. You've already lost that bet.
You're done. Yeah, true enough. So how did you come from what was next after Gustavus? Was it the Peace Corps? Is that what you did right away after graduating? Tell us a little bit about how you got that gig.
Sure. I had a couple professors. A history professor, but also Professor Melama. He's, you know, again, he was a, I had many, many classes with him. He was a curriculum two professor. He was a physics professor. And as you know, if you talk to him for 5 minutes, he'll mention the word Malaysia and how he went there in Peace Corps and how it changed his life. And anyway, so like I got a lot of feedback, I would say indirectly, about the idea that the Peace Corps was something you could do after college. And, you know, having known people who did it, I thought it seemed really interesting. And also, crucially, I didn't have anything else that I knew I wanted to do. So
I was waiting for that.
Yeah. I mean, and I have no problem with that. Like Peace Corps at the time, their tagline was like, adventure is calling, will you answer or whatever. So like, I really thought, you know, I don't have a lot going on. I was happy to have an adventure. I was interested in learning new languages and, you know, like living in another country and sort of experiencing other cultures. So it felt like something that was fun and cool to do. And so, I got certainly a lot of encouragement, but that was basically, I graduated in June and I think I was, on a plane by January.
And was that to Johannesburg, or where were you?
So the region that our group was in the Mpumalanga province, which is about an hour and a half northeast of Pretoria. So I think, we flew to Joburg, and then they immediately put you in a bus, and then they take you to a training place. So I spent almost no time whatsoever in Johannesburg, but my 2 years was in a small, what would have been in apartheid called a township outside. I would just say loosely outside Pretoria, about 2 hours. There's a rural area. One paved road, and I didn't have electricity and water, running water were pretty scarce. It was very different. Yeah.
Wow. What were you doing?
What was I doing? That's a great question. As Professor Melman will tell you, even in the joke is in the 60s, when you went to India, they drop you off on a bus and they say, do something good here. And, we'll pick you up 2 years later, that is an oversimplification, of course. And today there's lots of, I could have produced a piece of paper that had a very specific job and job description. And so officially on that piece of paper, so South Africa ended apartheid, and before where they had literally a Department of Education for every race, the quote unquote race of whites had a different Department of Education than the race of blacks, so to speak. That's not even so to speak. They decided that, we should have one Department of Education for every child, regardless of their race, in South Africa. And so they continued to update their curriculum and their national curriculum statement. And when I was there, they were updating that national curriculum with a new program, which was called RNCS, Revised National Curriculum Statement, which sounds very boring. But it's basically, the job was officially to help primary schools and primary school teachers implement new and national curriculum standards. So I was trained in you might outcome-based learning and things like that. So I had no experience whatsoever doing that. And I did learn a lot about actually how to implement national curriculum standards and help a third grade teacher meet their objectives for their schools. But I still don't think it's much different than they drop you off and 2 years later they expect you to do. So I did have this fancy job title, but really grassroots development is extraordinarily difficult, and it really is just built on the personal relationships that you make. And so lots of the things I feel like I'm most proud of that I did there had nothing to do with RNCS or my job in the primary school teacher. And I also think lots of my biggest failures and waste of time probably were related to my job description. So it sort of goes in both directions.
Well, what are some of the things you were most proud of? If you can, I'm sure you remember not that long ago. Yeah.
It was a lot of ancient. It was long. It was 20 years ago almost.
I guess it was long ago.
Yeah. I think, they're always going to be personal relationships. So I think, after school, I would teach the equivalent of AP Calc at the local high school. So I was mostly tied to primary school, but I was, I would just go to this because I was, I was fresh off a physics major, which basically meant that I was strong in physics and calculus. And so I went and would basically help seniors and juniors prepare for a end of year test that was what you might think of as the equivalent for AP Calc or AP Physics, and just getting to know those kids and helping them I think was really good. I helped someone from our village ended up coming to Minnesota for senior year of high school. I thought that was just that's a very small change, which is almost the opposite of what the Peace Corps is intended to do, but that is a very personal and helping someone a lot. And just in general, I think making a bunch of friends there and getting to know people and learning to speak Sotho, which is, I was in an area where they spoke Northern Sotho in Setswana. And so just those cultural experiences, I feel never go away. So those are the things that you sort of remember most. And of course, all the other American friends that I made there who are my cohort in the Peace Corps, a lot of them still are some of my best friends today, and a bunch of us still live in the city here in New York.
Yeah, that's cool. There's a friend of ours, Kate's of mine, who was in the Peace Corps, a little younger than I am. I'm 70, but now retired teacher and kind of assistant principal. But he talks about that. I mean, he still gets together with his Peace Corps buddies. It's pretty amazing.
Oh, yeah.
The bond you make. The other, so that just sounds like an amazing experience to me. I studied abroad, not the Peace Corps isn't study abroad. I went to Mexico as a junior, and that just I still think about it. I still have so many profound memories and important memories. But from South Africa and the Peace Corps. Is it then you go to journalism school, or how, what was the next step?
That's exactly right. I applied to journalism school from South Africa. I took the GRE in Johannesburg. I still remember. And in the Peace Corps, as many volunteers would tell you, time is what you got. So I had a lot of time and I had no electricity. So there's not a lot of other things going on. So I remember like at night I would like actually study for like the GRE, which I had never done before. And
that's crazy.
I didn't really know exactly why, like the specifically journalism school, or I didn't, you know, I knew that I wanted to know how to make things. Like I wanted to learn how to build a website, and I wanted to learn how to shoot and edit video, and I wanted to learn to be a better writer. And I didn't necessarily know that like I want to work at a newspaper, or I want to produce a TV show, or I want to have a blog or anything like that. I knew I wanted the skills to sort of communicate in a modern way. And so I thought at the time journalism school was the best way for me to do that. And because I was a Peace Corps volunteer, the University of Missouri has a fellowship where you basically get a free ride if you're a Peace Corps volunteer. So that's why I went to Mizzou, is because they had a great scholarship for me.
That's fantastic. What, I mean, this is a hard question to answer, I'm sure, but what do you think is behind that desire or drive to communicate in those modern ways that you felt at the time you were applying? And I still feel.
Yeah, I have absolutely no idea is the short answer. I think probably some version of what I mentioned when I talked about being a physics major and English minor, which is that I've always been interested in both technology and like media, so to speak, and also in more classical forms of communication, like, you know, writing. I just in the sense of I've always had a foot in both spheres of the brain, I think. And I've never been, even here at the Times, I'm not by any stretch the best technologist or even close to all the people who work on the second floor of the New York Times. And I'm not even remotely as good as the best reporter at writing, but I'm better at writing than the technologists and better at technology than the reporters. And that has been a good home for me in general. So I feel like that sort of thing has always been something I'm interested in, that crossover or that intersection of the Venn diagram between technology and communication.
You just took the word out of my mouth. Intersection or interdisciplinarity. You're a walking example of how valuable that can be. So, had you done any of this kind of tech stuff prior to getting to the Times?
I mean, I guess it sort of depends what you mean by tech stuff. So, as a physics major, you have to learn a lot of technology, and I think lots of physics majors would like say that if they can take classical mechanics, they can do anything, you know. But I think probably, you know, and even in, I didn't take this, and I was, because I was known to be too difficult, but they had a class called Visual Fortran in the physics department that was a J-term class that was apparently extraordinarily hard, but that was like a full immersion and like, so it's just programming. And I didn't take it because it was too hard, and ended up taking a class about called the Champion's Edge, which was guaranteed to get an A, which I didn't get an A in the class. But I think in general, I was always, you know, had the physics for sure prepared me for, the technology part and, you know, just, but I didn't necessarily know like what to do with it. And I was not a strong physics student. So I knew that research studies was not going to be for me.
Okay. You weren't making videos or TV shows or anything like that as an undergraduate.
No, but we did. I guess I did some writing for some student journals or whatever. And I did, we do have to produce the equivalent of like reports in, even when you're doing like lab experiments. And I found that I really enjoyed that part of it. Like I still remember thinking about the data that I was collecting and like the Frankhertz experiment or stuff like that. So I feel like there's certainly aspects of it there, but there weren't that many avenues at the time where you could express that sort of thing.
Yeah. So I just love all the tools. I mean, to me, it's interesting when I'm speaking to someone who's career path or whatever phrase you want to use has lots of twists and turns. And had it not been Steve Melema meeting you that day when you're registering for your first semester, who knows what you would have majored in. Because, you know, at least in part because he had been in the Peace Corps, you wind up in the Peace Corps. Journalism, and then after the MA in journalism, do you go right to the New York Times? What happens next?
Yeah, that's another I was very lucky. They had a visiting scholar program at the time. So I was just a master's student at Mizzou, and they had a program in which they would have professionals come and teach a class for one semester. So it'd be like the equivalent of if I, working at the New York Times, if the Times let me go to the University of Minnesota and teach a journalism class for one semester and then come back to my job. And so okay. I randomly took a class called Information Graphics by a man named John Dukneski, who was at the time the graphics editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer newspaper. That a lot has changed the Inquirer since then, but at the time they were an extraordinary, they had an extraordinary graphics department. He was one of the best like mappers of data or GIS specialists working in media in the whole country. And I think I took a class from him, and that was like a skills transfer. Like information graphics, the field of graphics for sure really is like a craft in the sense of like I teach it to you or I teach it to someone else, right, or you learned it. And so like it really is like a skill that you are. I'm not saying it's the same as carpentry by any stretch, but it's a
skill. It's a craft. Yeah.
I really attribute lots of, or a huge share of my success to him, because he personally just sat me down. He was an extraordinary teacher, and I got lucky because he wasn't there the semester before I was there, and he wasn't there the semester after.
Wow.
And I worked with him. And the thing with the journalism market at the time, which is like before that class, I had, just like everyone else, I had my newspaper clips and I had my little examples and my stories that I'd written as a student, but so did everyone else. And so as soon as I was able to demonstrate a specific skill, my prospects increased dramatically. And I also had the benefit of being numerate, which many journalists, the vast majority of journalists are not numerate. And so mm-hmm. it went from being something that I wasn't using at all, like the numeracy and data skills that I learned in college, to something that was like the reason I was able to get jobs on the sort of more innovative front. So
that's
so great. Basically the reason that I did an internship at the Inquirer with John after graduation. And then the world is small enough that a couple internships later, one is at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, I was able to get an internship at the Times in 2008, and I never left.
That's just fantastic. And what is it? I mean, what did that feel? I mean, for me, there are plenty of criticisms to make of any newspaper, including the New York Times, but I confess I'm still kind of in awe of the New York Times. I've been reading it since I was a kid, when my dad would pick it up. I can still remember getting the Sunday New York Times hooks. But what sure. Did you feel that? I mean, what is it like to work at the New York Times?
Yeah, I definitely did feel that. Not to say that I don't anymore, but I feel like, especially, you know, even when you say newspaper, like I'm not giving you any PR right now. Like I truly don't think newspaper, like that word doesn't enter my head anymore. Like I would know. Right. It's like, I know that, like, I'm not trying to tell you that you should think of it as a global news organization, but
yeah.
You know, we have,
yeah, it's not a
daily is a flagship podcast, and we have a new email newsletter that goes out to a bajillion people, and we have a massive internet platform. But I think at the time, the reason I'm bringing that up is at the time, you know, when I was an intern, I still remember like even making what you would think of as a humble chart, like a one column, you know, like a newspaper is six columns, modern newspaper is six columns long or wide. And so like a one column chart is like the smallest chart you can make. And I still remember thinking, like, as I'm making one, that typing my little name under that chart in the New York Times font, thinking like, this is really cool. I'm really excited about this. I can't believe this is happening, and so on. Or like, even at the time, I really wanted to do interactive graphics and seeing like the work from like Sean Carter and Amanda Cox and thinking like, entering my name such it looks like John and Amanda's name and then mine's right next to it. Like, I still remember feeling like really cool about that. Like, obviously that goes away after you've been there 15 years. But I think that, that really was, especially when I was an intern, like, cause I knew the names of everybody in the department and I was like, which one is this? I want to go meet Sean. I want to go meet Amanda. Like, which one is she? Someone pointed out to me. So like, I really felt like I don't want to go as far as say meeting my heroes, but I was really meeting people whose work I really knew and really admired. And that was, I mean, that's an amazing feeling.
That's just awesome. So was your internship with the Upshot or did that come later?
No, the Upshot came later. So I started at the Times as an intern in the New York Times graphics department. So the job was graphics editor. And again, I think that is one of the best jobs in the field of journalism is to be a New York Times graphics editor. I still think of myself as a New York Times graphics editor, even all these years later. But the Upshot started in 2014. And so I was just part of the graphics department at large for 6 years, and I joined the Upshot when it started, with David Leinhardt started in 2014, after Nate Silver left the Times. That is like the shortest possible reason for why there's a desk called the Upshot. It's because someone named Nate Silver left the New York Times and started his own news organization called 538. So I started.
Yeah, I've read different. I mean, some people say it's because Nate Silver, but I don't know. Is it that simple? I mean, with the
upshot, it is that simple.
It is that simple. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love it.
The upshot has become so much more than, you know, it is like, that's the reason, the original reason for why there's a desk called The Upshot is because the New York Times wanted more quantitative, empirical, political journalism like the kind Nate was doing. But what David ended up building was like much more than that. And it was also sort of like a tool with which he could change the New York Times in all the ways he wanted to change it. So it's much more than just a replacement for 538, right. The hole that was left. But that is certainly the impetus for why, like,
okay,
someone at the top said, we should have a new desk that does empirical journalism and XYZ. But it is, you know, it's grown and changed dramatically since then. But that is the reason for the desk, for sure.
It's just awesome. I mean, I truly love it. And I am lousy at data. And maybe that's why I love it. The whole range of topics, isn't there? I mean, well, we could do podcasts just about one of the topics. One I was looking at recently, what was it called? Something about, can you tell how people vote by where they live, sure, or something like that.
Yep.
You do things on sports. You're doing the, I don't know if it was you who created the, whatever that's called. Is it the election needle or the needle, whatever the hell
it's
called?
Yep, the needle, which is probably our most famous, famous is maybe not the right word, but I would say that the needle is probably the most recognizable data visualization in the media. A huge team of people created and make that, but that definitely came out of The Upshot for sure.
Yeah, that's cool. That's awesome. So what is it like? I mean, I'm sure you'll say every day is different, but just in general, what is it like to be editor of The Upshot? You were deputy editor for a time. I think I noted that. You're the editor, man. You're it. What's it like? What's your job like on a day-to-day basis?
It's great. I have to tell myself that when I think about, you know, because it's still a job and I still like to, everyone, I like to complain about my job, just like anyone does. But then I'm like, no, actually, this is as good as a job that exists in the field of American media. So you should be happy with it. And it is truly... it's really great. I think probably, you know, lots of people are like, even when you were just jokingly saying like, you're the editor, man. I think lots of people are like, yes, you have all these people who are there to do what you say, you know, but I think the reality is, and I'm happy about this, is more that like, I'm the coach of a basketball team, like full of all-stars, and I'm there to help them. All of them are like more important and smarter than I am. And I'm there to help them do their best work. So we have people like, I think Nate Cohn is the New York Times' chief political analyst, and he's part of The Upshot. And like, he's sort of like a Steph Curry, and I'm just like his coach, Steve Kerr. So like, you know, I make sure that he has what he needs to do the best work he can, because he is truly essential. Or Emily Badger, Claire Kane Miller, Atish Bhatia, Josh Katz. I could just go on and on and on with the staff. But I think in general, it is just really about enabling extraordinarily talented people to do their best work. And I'm thrilled that I get to be a part of it.
So is it collaborative also when it comes to what The Upshot will feature on at any given point? How does that process work?
Absolutely. I think even when we tell job applicants, it's like, not only is collaboration a part of your job, but you should be enthusiastic. Like, this is a perk, not a requirement for the job. Like, this is something that we want you to be excited about. So if you look, not all, but a huge share of our best work has, you know, two or three bylines on it or more. And I think part of that is just that, like, the nature of modern communication is such that you need people who are excellent and deep reporters on specific subjects like education or elections or healthcare or cities. But you also need people who understand technology and design and like the nature of communication and information such that they can work together and together produce something that no one person could do on their own. So those are the kinds of projects that I'm most proud to foster at the Times.
Yeah, and Gustavus, like a lot of schools, is now emphasizing much more than ever the importance of collaboration.
You just can't do the job in today's world if you like by yourself. There's almost no part of the New York Times where you can succeed on your own. And again, I think that is ultimately a good story.
So that's important advice to any current or prospective students listening. So I'm just trying to think, yeah, I mean, the visuals are so cool. Let's take the one how weird is the heat in Portland, Seattle, and Vancouver?
Sure. Yep.
So you come up with a topic and then, do you work on the visuals yourself? Or are you you're more hands off waiting to see what the team produces?
So with that specific question, again, everything always starts with the news. Like, the news is what drives what we do. We are journalists first and foremost, so we don't like make amazing charts and find a reason in the news to put them in the news. It's like the other way around. So The reason for that piece is that Portland, Oregon was experiencing extraordinary heat. I think they had, I'd have to check, but it was like 4 days in a row above 100 or something like that, which is just wild for that geography, for that part of the country. And so that is like the news, which is the weather in Portland is extraordinarily hot, hotter than it is normally. How can we communicate that to our readers? So like that is the news peg or the news story that we want to convey. Now, 20 years ago, we might have just written a newspaper story describing it, or you might think of like the New Yorker who they would like twist themselves about describing a chart over like four paragraphs, and they would never print any words. They'd write all the words out in longhand. But I think we had at the time Atish Bhatia, who he actually has a PhD in physics, which is annoying because I used to be like the physics person on our desk. But now we have Atish. He started, you know, he's someone who understands numbers and data, and he understands, and he'd done some reporting about, like, the National Weather Service just has an incredible amount of information. And so he sort of started pulling data from, I think NOAA or the National Weather Service just has tons and tons and tons of historical data at weather stations. And so we just started pulling it. And that data is, it's not actually that hard to get 100 years worth of very detailed data for a city or for a handful of cities relatively quickly. And so he was able to just make a chart of basically the historical data every day in Portland for the last, I don't know what it was, 100 years or something. And then we were able to plot the last 3 days on it on top of that. And sure enough, you can see much better than with words could tell you. If like you can just see in that chart how weird it is. And that was just the very top of the story. And like that is like, you know, a dramatic oversimplification of probably many days of work. But I think that sort of thing where people together go from a news story, think about what technology is available to help you communicate that to readers, and then work to produce it for a mass audience. I think that, in a nutshell, is what we do.
Yeah, and I was going to ask you about many days. I mean, how is it? I mean, is it typically what, 3 days or more for one upshot? How long does it take?
That's a great question. The answer is always disappointing because the answer is it's as much time as you have.
As much time as you have. Yeah.
So for the something with news, like, the answer with a news story is always immediately, or we'll take it right now, or, you know, like we'll take it now. And then if you update it, we'll take it then too. But I think most, or for alternatively for like deeper feature stories or things that are more enterprise based. If I just had been working on this for a week and the news is really busy this week, and so we say, well, yeah, actually let's work on this for one more week. Like projects will expand to fill the available space. So like how much time something takes is not necessarily always so prescriptive, but I think, yeah, in general, lots of our best work is done between 1 and 2 weeks. And I think lots of daily work, you know, daily journalism is at the, you know, we're not a newspaper, but we still have daily journalism as like the core of what we do. And so when news dictates, we can move faster, even if I don't like to.
Are you?
I can be forced to move quickly if I must, but we don't. My preference is not to do that.
I'm kind of with you. Sometimes I think I say, you know, with this image people have of the college professor, I say, no, what do you do for a living? I get paid to rush, basically.
Yeah.
But that's another story. So are you working on, is the team working on multiple upshots at once or
one at a time? Yeah, absolutely. So we're still a relatively small staff. We're one of the smallest groups in the Times. So I think we're, depending how you count, we're about 15 people now. Whereas like the international desk of the New York Times is, you know, I don't even know, 70, 80, 90, something like that. It's much bigger. So we're very small. But I think we have a handful of reporters. We have a handful of people whose primary skill is in visuals, technology, data, that sort of thing. And so at any given moment, I'd say we have 3, 4, 5, 6 projects that are like on what we'd call like the front burner. So like, you know, I think publishing 3 things that are really good a week is great for us. But I feel like, you know, the New York Times publishes more than 100 stories every day. So I don't think that we suffer from publishing too little journalism. So I feel like our lane is really in quality rather than quantity.
Yeah. And it shows. I mean, the graphics are amazing. They're incredibly helpful. And by the way, I think the history quiz part of the upshot?
Flashback is an upshot.
Yeah, I'm addicted.
It's our creation. Oh, that's great.
I love it.
Hear. We're hoping to go more into that space in the coming years.
Please do.
Yeah. The idea of like daily quizzes or daily interactive experiences is, I think, something we're really pushing on right now.
Yeah, I really like that, which reminds me Well, I tried Wordle. Now I do Spelling Bee. I'm addicted to that. But did you do something with Wordle, or you or the Upshot?
Yeah, we did. The Upshot created what I'd call a companion tool for both of those things. So before the New York Times purchased Wordle, which it did a few years ago, my colleague Josh Katz and another journalist and developer, Matthew Conlin, had basically, they were really interested in it because Josh is a stats major, and this was at the time when, like, even though Wordle remains enormously popular, I think there was a time when, like, everybody was playing Wordle on Earth, right, or whatever. And so lots of people were coming out and saying, like, I have the best opening word because of math, and my word is ado. And then someone would say, no, my math tells me that the opening word should be least. And someone else, anyway, so whenever someone says that they know the right answer to something and math is the reason, Josh is always gets sort of like perked up. And so he started, we started developing something, and it ultimately became this tool called WordleBot, which sort of like, if you think of like a chess game, you can have you can get an analysis of your chess moves after the game. This is sort of like that. It sort of like rates your process at playing Wordle. Again, because it is about process, not like if you got it in two, it's like, did you get lucky, or are you good at Wordle? And so it is one of the most popular features in the history of the New York Times. It has a massive audience. Wow. And people play it every day. And so we have, obviously, Wordle is much, 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 much more. Like, I think we're getting just a small percentage of people who play Wordle to do WordleBot, but that's a big numerator. So it's enormously popular. I mean, based on the success of that, we created something similar. That's more of a companion and helper rather than something that judges you, but it's called Spelling Bee Buddy. And if you play Spelling Bee, it's just a tool that can help you. It knows what you've guessed, and it knows what words are remaining, and it can give you hints and help you just track your progress. So those two things are both very popular.
Yeah, I've actually gone to that. I haven't used it that much, but I know of it. So you're part of that too, your team.
Yeah, that came from our team. Yep.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. A colleague at Gustavus introduced me to Spelling Bee, and I just can't. I mean, I'm up late sometimes. You know, it's crazy sacrificing sleep to finish damn Spelling Bee if I can.
I know.
Anyway,
it has a very specific audience. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm special. The or specific or distinctive. You know, the thing I'm thinking about, first of all, just looking at the Upshot and all the different topics, must be really cool and fun. There's just such an array of topics, including sports, politics, and the environment, climate, you name it. Is there a particular, I don't know what the right word is, genre, or you're more drawn to one sort of general topic than the other, politics, sports? Like, you've done stuff on pitching, I think,
yep.
For example. Go ahead.
So I think there's not one answer. I feel like when David started the Upshot, he gave it a tagline called politics, policy, and everyday life. And he did that very intentionally, which is that I challenge you to find any topic under the sun that does not include one of those three things. You know what I mean? And so he wanted to cast a really broad net. And so I wouldn't say we're like a magazine, but I think if there is no subject under the sun, I think that we would consider to be off limits. Although some subjects lend themselves better to our skill set than others. I think the thing that really, if we had to pick one, it would probably be something empirical or empiricism or data analysis that is like sort of a common theme, not overarching or not always, but that is something that sort of like we were able to, so with that baseball example that you mentioned, so these pitchers were using
the sticky substance, whatever the hell it was.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. I can't believe it's on the tip of my tongue. I'll have to think of it. But basically, it was a substance that was used by literal strongmen, like body people who lift rocks for competitions. But they found it was very good at getting torque on the ball. And so we're like, there were way more no hitters than there had ever been, like midway through the season, and strikeouts were way up. And so we thought, like, is there a way that we can find out what's happening here using data? And so a normal traditional sports story would be to talk to players and teams and managers and write a story about what they think is happening. But in modern baseball, there are 12 optical cameras. I think there are 12 in every stadium, and they film every single pitch. So when you like watch the Twins game online, you can get a play by play and they'll say, this was a cutter, this was a fastball, here's where it landed. And so they can categorize these, and basically we could show what the spin rate was of baseballs, and we could compare it to the spin rate of previous years because that data is just on the internet. And so like that is about baseball, but we don't have any baseball writers on our staff. So we were able to reach out to the sports department and say, here's a story, we think it's good, and it's true. would Tyler Kepner, the New York Times' national baseball writer, be interested in participating with us? Because if we want a comment from the commissioner of baseball, they don't know who Kevin and Josh are, but they do know who Tyler Kepner is. And so like that sort of thing, I think, allows us to work like within our expertise and authority, which is data analysis and making analytical conclusions about the news from some empirical source. But we also work with people across the newsroom who are deep experts in a specific subject area, who know the people in and out, who know things that data can never tell you, and so on. So I think that sort of thing is like a sweet spot for us.
Yeah, that's so cool. It's in a way, you're echoing in a way your combination of physics and English. I mean, writing and I mean you still need the you know journalists, right? The people with the connections and who, if they make a call to the baseball commissioner, he or she will answer. But then the part I love, I'm still not a data geek or person, but I do love the upshot, the way it uses data and the visualization of data to kind of, for me, one of the things I love in life is being surprised or learning that what I thought was the case is not the case. And not that that's, I don't think that that's the, you know, the agenda of the upshot. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but sometimes that's so cool. Like, you know, you're thinking, well, do these Nike, I'm thinking about the thing you did about Nike and the running shoes. Do they really, do they really, really make you run faster? Well, didn't you find out they in fact do, right? Am I remembering correctly?
Yeah. Bless you for bringing up my favorite New York Times story that I've ever done of all time. But that's exact sort of thing, which is like, it starts with the news, which is that, like, you know, in fact, the Times and other places had written like, wow, marathon times are really dropping. And you hear from runners anecdotally, and I was certainly one of them, that Nike has this fancy shoe that purports to make you faster. But like the sort of unknowable in many ways, like, you know, it's a very good marketing campaign by them. But I think we were able to identify a natural experiment happening in the world every day, which is that millions of people around the world participate in races, and they upload their results publicly to Strava. Strava is a company that calls itself a social media website for athletes. And so like there would be like a website, a URL on the internet, like Kevin Quayle's New York Marathon. And it would have the splits that I had for the race. It'd have my race time. And for crucially, it would have a self-reported shoe. So it was this massive data set that we were able to amass that had more than a million marathons and half marathons from men and women over the last 4 years. And we could basically use statistical techniques to not only prove the correlation of these fast times and shoes, which you would naturally suspect that faster runners are more likely to pick these fancy shoes, but that the shoes literally cause you, and like they pass statistical tests for causality to say we can be reasonably confident that the same runner wearing this shoe will run faster than wearing another shoe. And we did it through all sorts of ways. So yeah, that is, that's probably the most advanced statistics we've done aside from the work behind the New York Times needle, which is very fancy. But I think that is some of the hardest stats that we've done that I've done in my career, for sure.
Is that why it's your favorite? Why you said, I think you said it was one of your favorite or your.
It is. Well, one, it was the last time I did, I don't actually get to do anything anymore. So like that was one of the last times where I was like very involved in the doing, you know, the writing and the reporting and the building. But also, I think it's an example. Well, I'm also personally a runner. So like I was able to answer a question for myself. Like lots of good journalism actually comes out of people being confused about something they care about themselves, you know?
Sure.
And just like, it's a big question. Does this shoe make you faster? And the data is just on the internet. The answer is right there. If you know where to look, if you know how to do it. And it's just like, oh, we were able to conclusively and authoritatively demonstrate a new fact that previously was not possible to be reported without the methods that we did. So I just feel like it's a completely unique piece of journalism and something we could demonstrate like, yes, New York Times journalism can look like this. It doesn't always have to be, we talked to four people and said X, Y, Z. I know that's a dramatic oversimplification, of course. But I feel like it was a very strong demonstration of a kind of empirical journalism that I think more media organizations can employ.
It was so cool. I love that story. And I'm just joking. I don't know. Well, maybe not. Did Nike sales skyrocket afterwards, or did they?
I don't know. I believe. No, I mean, we got a comment from them. Because you know, we set out not knowing the answer, and we were fully prepared to have it be like, actually, no, these shoes don't mean anything, and we can prove it. I think so. Like, there's sort of a story either way, but no, we don't write the story conditional on what we think Nike's response will be. So, yeah. No, I have no idea. But they are, we were able to sort of, I think something like 20 or 30%, some large number of all sub-3 marathons in the Strava data were by people reporting those shoes, which is just crazy number. Just like I wouldn't say that we caused that mass adoption of those shoes, but we may be correlated with it.
You used the word, I think you said causality or something like that.
Yeah.
And I love that because as a historian, historians were obsessed with context and causation. And that's the other thing I love about the upshot. It's just always interesting to me. I love politics, so I'm more drawn to that stuff. But people listening, look at the upshot, read it, subscribe to the New York Times. I mean, get the upshot. Can you subscribe to the upshot separately? I don't know. Is that even-
you can't. You can subscribe to Nate's newsletter, but we have a homepage, newyorktimes.com/upshot. And we have a Twitter account and we have a Facebook page and all those other things. But I think it's easy to find if you're looking. There's a tab on the website too if you want to look there. But yeah.
Do it, listeners. How about, I'm just curious about how someone gauge the popularity of the upshot as a feature of the Times?
Yeah, we do have some of these measurements are relatively crude. Like it's like there is what you might think of as a page view, which is like a metric that lots of media organizations use to say like how many page views did something get, but that's crude because it's like it may be a loyal page view or an unloyal page view. Like the thing we really want is we want to get people to value our work so much that they subscribe to the Times. That's what pays our bills. And so like there's lots of different measures for what constitutes success in an empirical fashion. Also, like there's lots of really important international reporting, including now in Israel and in Gaza or in Ukraine, that is extraordinarily important and central to the New York Times' mission that we know will not get lots of page views, and we're absolutely fine with that. And so like we don't want to like equate quality and page views, but however you measure it, the upshot, I'm very happy that we punch above our weight for sure. So
that's fantastic.
Our readers definitely value the work.
That's great. That's wonderful. And I mean, I'm a newspaper junkie. I know it's not a newspaper news organization. and my wife too, I loved it when I was growing up. Holding the paper, we get it delivered. We get the paper copy early in the morning here in Minneapolis where we live. And I also look at it online, and we sometimes think, do we really need the paper copy? Yeah, we need the paper copy. I thought about holding that.
Well, bless you. Newspaper.
Oh yeah. No, it's so important for all kinds of reasons. So, this has been a blast. It's really been fun. I love your story. And again, all the twists and turns, so what do you do with a physics major? Well, you wind up as an editor at the New York Times. That's one thing you can do. What about, you live in Brooklyn or where do you live?
That's right. I live in Brooklyn in a neighborhood called Windsor Terrace, which is near Prospect Park.
I've
lived all over Brooklyn in my time. I lived in Manhattan for a bit too, but I'm in Brooklyn at the moment.
So I mentioned before we started recording, my wife, Kate, she was born in the Village. And then at some point way before it was trendy, her parents moved to Brooklyn Heights on Henry Street there. And that's where she basically grew up.
Gorgeous neighborhood.
Yeah. And God, Brooklyn, I mean, I don't know. You may know it would be the fifth largest city if it were a separate city, something like that.
Yeah. Something like 2 million people live here.
Yeah. It's just amazing to explore. So, have fun. Good luck with the upshot.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure speaking with you. I will send this recording on to Professor Melema and others. And I will look you up. I will let you know because we come to New York at least once a year. Kate has it's her twin brother who lives there and to see him and see friends. In fact, I wish I had known. We were there this summer seeing some theater and having a good time. But I will look you up and lunch or coffee or whatever. Yeah. So, Kevin, thanks a lot.
To it.
Take good
Thank
care.
You.
Likewise. All right. Cheers. Bye-bye. See ya. Learning for Life at Gustavus is supported by the Offices of Marketing and Communication and the Provost. The views expressed in this podcast are not necessarily those of Gustavus itself.